This is the Human Action Podcast, where we debunk the economic, political, and even cultural myths of the days. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Murphy.
Daniel, welcome to the Human Action Podcast.
Thank you so much. A great pleasure to be here.
Well, glad you could join us. So, folks, just to give some background, I had been planning on doing an independent episode going through the mechanics of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, and my take was going to be, I know that people that probably listeners to this podcast generally side with, like Rand Paul and Thomas Massie and so on, and then later on even Elon Musk, were coming out saying, this bill is an abomination, this is crazy. And then you had people like Stephen Miller on Twitter saying, what are you talking about? This has got record spending cuts and there's big tax cuts. You know, it's locking in tax cuts from the first term and so forth. And what do you want us to do? We got to start somewhere. And I was going to take a sort of nuanced position and say I agree with all of them that Stephen Miller's not wrong when he's saying that this does contain record spending cuts and so on, and that the quote increase in the deficit is due entirely to the fact that it cuts taxes more than it cuts spending, but it is making spending lower. But on the other hand, I'll throw one data point out here, Daniel, I'll let you comment. I do see where people are talking about, because when they say there's spending reductions, they mean relative to the baseline, and it's kind of hard to back that out. But the CBO scoring says it's a $1.3 trillion cut in spending over 10 years, but it's a $3.7 trillion cut in revenue. And so that's why it increases the deficit $2.4 trillion. But again, on Rothbardian terms, that's fine. It's cutting spending. That's like the ultimate driver of how the government, just takes resources in the private sector, and who could be against tax cuts, right? So, but then on the other hand, I get where some people are talking, like Rand Paul and Thomas Massie, because again, these are CBO numbers, and I know, Daniel, you're going to challenge these, but on face value, they're projecting, right now spending is, call it $7 trillion. By 2034, outlays, the baseline would be $10.9 trillion, and with this big, beautiful bill, they'd only be $10.7 trillion.
Yeah.
Right? So when you spread the $1.3 trillion in spending cuts over 10 years against that crazy baseline with all the growth packed into it, you can understand why people are saying, we're still heading for the iceberg, we're barely moving. And so anyway, I'll stop there. And what do you want to say, Daniel? Oh, and then I saw, though, that Daniel, you had written a qualified defense of this as well, aimed at an Austro-libertarian audience. And so that's why I thought, oh, instead of me just doing it myself, why don't I have Daniel come on and we can talk about it together. So the floor is yours.
Let's talk to, I would start from the same premise you say. We agree. We agree with Mr. Paul and Elon Musk about the need to cut spending decisively. And we need also to understand that we need to be realists and that we need to start from a point in which the number one priority is to cut taxes, because that's the only way in which you curb the abomination that really is the intentions of almost any government to continue to increase expenditure. No? But think about what you have just outlined, which I think is exceedingly important. The CBO baseline is something that we can all work with, and I'm happy to discuss those estimates, because I start with a big question, which is, I cannot even start to believe that libertarians and Austrians are accepting the CBO's idea that a tax cut is an increase in expenditure, because it's not. Okay, so it's not the same in any shape or form. The second thing that I cannot understand is why libertarians and Austrians are not accounting for any single improvement in revenues, in growth, in investment, and in productivity coming from the tax cuts and the deregulation. I think that the deregulation aspect of the Big Beautiful Bill is exceptionally important. Okay, so we need to see it from the perspective both of the spending cuts, which when you look at it in nominal terms, going from an estimate of 10.9 trillion to 10.7, that looks very little. But in real terms, it is very significant. It is absolutely relevant. And it's also very relevant in terms of GDP, which is also a very relevant measure when we think about the level of indebtedness. So I have a few criticisms of the CBO estimates. Number one, they assume no improvement in economic growth. Even the Tax Foundation only has an 0.8% improvement in economic growth from the baseline. That doesn't make any sense to me, precisely because the baseline comes from a 2024 in which the private sector was completely obliterated. The entirety of the 2024 GDP growth came from deficit spending, no? So that's on the one hand. So if you think about this big, beautiful bill as a starting point to curb the immense problem of government spending, it does. Reducing taxes and therefore letting the private sector breathe, it does. Deregulation, it does. And what's most important, we have to look at it as an arrow, I think about it. You have to look at it as something that is a starting point. When that starts to work, then you have another layer of improvement that comes from the discretionary spending cuts, which can be quite significant. And more importantly, what we will also get is that all of the negotiations of trade deals that the administration is achieving will also reduce import expenditure and improve export income. And therefore, with those two factors, the GDP growth that is going to come from this big, beautiful bill is a more productive, a more sustainable, and a more robust level of economic growth. No? So I think that we need to look at it from a holistic perspective. On the one hand, if anybody, be it Mr. Paul or Mr. Musk, believe that you could get more than $1.6 trillion of mandatory spending cuts from the configuration of Congress and Senate the way that they are today, be my guest, we're not in a dictatorship. That is not easy to achieve, and that is already an incredible achievement. Remember that I think that we had a conversation with Ryan a few months ago in which we said mandatory spending is never going to be cut, and that is the problem of the U.S. fiscal situation. So that on the one hand. On the other hand, what I think is very important is to prove that this is a pro-growth strategy. And this is important in order not to get a backlash in terms of political support, and that suddenly, because of a too abrupt reduction in spending that you cannot get anyway with the configuration of Congress and Senate that exists today, you could have reached a situation in which neither the tax cuts nor the spending cuts would have been approved in a year on a year or a half time. So I think that all those things put together show us that This is a first step that needs to be supported because it is the best thing relative to the alternative. And we must remember what the alternative was. The alternative was the extension of the tax cuts it doesn't happen. And therefore you have the highest increase in taxes for the middle class and for small and medium enterprises in the past 10 years. Plus completely out of control level of mandatory spending. And the other criticism, and sorry to extend myself, is that the spending cuts are backloaded. Of course they're backloaded. When the administration arrives in power day one, 75%, 80% of the budget of the current year has already been spent. Obviously, the spending cuts are going to happen in mid-26, beginning of 27, because any administration that arrives has basically received already the inheritance of an enormous level of expenditure that has already been committed.
Okay, great. Yeah, a lot there. And basically, why don't we just spend the rest of this episode unpacking everything you just said there? Okay, so one critical thing, let's just make sure I elaborate upon that up front to make sure we don't lose people. When people are talking about tax cuts, and that's, again, the according to CBO scoring, a drop of $3.7 trillion in revenue over 10 years, a lot of that is simply extending or making permanent the tax cuts that came in under the first Trump administration that were scheduled to phase out. And partly the reason they do that, just for people at home, is so that it's partly a scoring game where if you make it so the tax cuts are temporary, then when the CBO scores it, that means their quote total cost is lower than you know, and that's what you're talking about, Daniel, about how they treat a spending cut the same as a revenue increase in terms of its cost when, you know, philosophically and even economically, I don't think those are at all interchangeable. So that's partly what's going on here. So I guess maybe a different way of saying it, and I'll ask you your response here, Daniel, is if they weren't to do this and let things continue on the so-called baseline, it's not that the tax code stays the same. It's that you get this massive tax increase. And CBO, I think you and I agree, is not correctly showing actually what would happen to revenue growth with this giant tax increase that's scheduled to occur, that actually the deficit would be a lot worse because they're not fully incorporating just how devastating that would be to economic growth. Whereas with this big, beautiful bill and, you know, not having that tax hike happen and then doing some other tax cuts, the economy grows faster than CBO is projecting. And so that's partly the difference in why you're saying the big, beautiful bill is a lot better than some of the critics are alleging.
Absolutely. Think about this. The CBO assumes no opportunity cost from eliminating the existing tax cuts. That is crazy. That is absolutely crazy. Number two, the CBO got the estimates of revenue growth wrong from the tax cuts that were extended, not just throughout 2021 to 2024, but into this period of 25. No? So the tax cuts have been better in terms of revenue and receipt figures than what the CBO expected. And the fact is that the Biden administration kept those tax cuts and have generated record revenues. So did the Trump administration. So the problem is not the tax cuts or extending it. The real problem is the cost of opportunity and the enormous negative impact on investment, on growth, on consumption, and on revenues, as you very well said, of just letting those tax cuts expire and not extending them, therefore getting a massive tax increase. That's the one thing. What is the problem? The problem is mandatory spending. So let's focus on mandatory spending. This is the first time that Congress and Senate have the opportunity of really cutting mandatory spending. And we also must remember that the problem of mandatory spending that the CBO outlines and the Tax Foundation outline is not mandatory spending in real terms, but mandatory spending growth above the increase in GDP. This is super important because that is what's really, let's say, creating this enormous hole that grows faster despite economic growth. Okay. So what the mandatory spending cut does is actually to put a brake on mandatory spending growth above GDP, which is one of the biggest problem, not the biggest, with it, which is the main problem of the deficit increase relative to GDP of the United States, that despite economic growth, it continues to bloat and continues to bloat faster, even with economic growth. So those two things for me are very important. Also very important to me is to remind our good friends, libertarians, Austrians, freedom defenders, anyone that looks at economic data, not from a sectarian perspective and a government perspective, which is the way that the CBO looks at it. It looks at it from a tax collector perspective, but from the perspective of the productive economy. The deregulation and tax cut effect on economic growth, on investment, and on GDP, productive GDP growth, i.e. private sector GDP, those are all revenue positive. And finally, the elephant in the room that nobody seems to be talking about is an improvement in the trade deficit. We are seeing a number of trade negotiations that we may like, we may dislike, they may be imperfect, they may not be the best possible, but there's certainly an improvement in terms of revenue generation. Higher exports, lower imports, and certainly in those cases where some of the countries, like China did today, decided not to reduce their non-tariff barriers, a 55% tariff that is going to be generating revenues. So even if we forget about the alleged positive of tariff revenues, which can be hugely debatable, at least consider the improvement in the trade deficit.
Okay, yeah, great. So on the deregulation front, so there what's interesting too is you're saying besides just the big picture fiscal, you know, tax and expenditure changes, that you actually like a lot of the content of this bill, you know, because yeah. I've been sort of just doing a surface level, just trying to frame it for people. To give an example, I know I'm jumping around here, because I saw, I think it was Thomas Massey. Let me just, I have it, just to make sure I'm not misquoting him here, folks. But so Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent had said, this was on June 7th, folks, a $4 trillion tax hike, this is on Twitter, a $4 trillion tax hike next year would devastate American businesses and families. President Trump is committed to preventing that, and over 300 leading economists agree, right? So Bessent's point is, if we don't pass this thing, that means the Trump tax cuts expire, and that's effectively a $4 trillion tax hike next year that's scheduled to happen, right? That's part of the baseline, as it were. Absolutely. And then Massey, you know, retweets that, and then his comment was, the biggest tax will be when you must monetize the debt to pay for the BBB. The resulting inflation will substantially harm poor and middle-class families. You should advise the president to remove the $300 billion salt bribe to New York and California millionaires, his 2017 TCGA, the tax cut back then, didn't have it. So for there, I mean, I get his point, but I just thought it was a little bit weird that when Massey is trying to single out one particular thing, it's a tax cut, right? The salt tax, you know, it's saying, for people who don't know, that's the state and local tax deduction, you know, where you can itemize on your federal form. And so you don't have to get, you know, you're not paying again, you know, you get to deduct what you paid to your state and local. Hmm. And so there, again, when Massey had to pick one particular thing that he didn't like, he was pointing to a tax cut. So I'm saying, from a Rothbardian perspective, that's a little bit weird. Like, you could say, I would rather have a general rate reduction than having these particulars. Fair enough. But in terms of, you know, I would much prefer that he said he grabbed $300 billion in spending somewhere and said, cut that, as opposed to, why don't you get rid of this deduction that's, you know, letting people keep more of their money?
Yeah. And I come back to the Rothbardian view, and I come back to the Austrian view. It is profoundly intellectually dishonest from my perspective, to say that a tax cut, if it creates a deficit, is going to generate a monetization that is going to lead to a massive increase in inflation. That makes absolutely no sense, my friend. No sense whatsoever. The only monetization of deficit that creates inflation is the one that comes from higher government spending. If you cut government spending, and let's make this assumption. Imagine that tomorrow we had the ability to make the perfect decision, which is to bring down 100% government spending and cut all the taxes. No? Mm? Okay. Government would immediately have an enormous deficit, gigantic, in fact, but it would be hugely deflationary. Because if we don't understand that tax cuts don't generate inflation, that what generates inflation is when government increases the amount of money it creates by spending, which is money creation, and that what a tax cut is returning the same units of currency to the people that have created it. If we don't understand that basic concept of who prints money, government, versus who is using that money either to pay the tax or to keep it for themselves, to pay for goods and services, to save or to invest, whatever they want. If we don't understand that concept, then we are giving the entire intellectual and economic argument to socialism. It's completely false. No, if you tomorrow keep the same expenditure and bring taxes to zero, the deficit is going to balloon. But there is absolutely zero inflationary pressure. The only way in which you would get inflationary pressure is if you get the same taxes or higher, and higher government spending or even higher. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do see what you mean. And I know folks, some people at home might be quibbling about, like, well, how are they going to mount it? But let me say something I think is consistent with what you're saying, Daniel, but the people should totally get, is there was a period a while ago where Elon Musk was tweeting out clips from Milton Friedman where he was saying the ultimate tax is the government spending, right? And so, again, the idea being if the government spends $100 billion, whether they tax you up front for it, in which case it clearly, quote, costs $100 billion, or if they just print the money, it's clearly costing $100 billion in terms of, you know, higher prices. Or if they borrow it, well, they're just going to tax you down the road. And his point was that Elon Musk was endorsing, it's the government spending that's driving everything. That's really, you know, what's exactly redirecting resources. And so that's why I was saying it was ironic here when a lot of people were complaining about that. And then I went and looked at the CBO scoring and it showed this does cut spending. So that's the thing. So
you
yes.
have to look at the figures. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I had to post it on Twitter with a huge red circle to show people that it does cut spending.
Yes.
But it's important for us to repeat over and over and over again that the only thing that creates inflation is government spending bloating money velocity way above the private sector demand. The taxes I pay or the taxes I save are the same units of currency, it's only in the pocket of somebody else, either me or the government.
Yes, and I think that somebody sent me recently, Rothbard had a thing too where, there's a thing in Man, I think it's in Man Economy and State where there's the old school Keynesian idea of, oh, if inflation's getting out of hand, you can sop it up with tax hikes.
Exactly.
And his point was, how does that help me any that, you know, if I have, you know, oh, wow, the eggs are really expensive, but oh, instead of that, what if we took some of your money away? So now egg prices would fall. But if you took my money away to do that, then it's not obvious that's helping me. Right.
So it's a socialist trap. The socialist trap is government creates inflation by massively increasing the amount of money available in the economy by spending. That's way above what the private sector demands. Therefore, inflation comes up as what it is, which is a de facto default. No, it's a slow default. It's like is the manifestation of the insolvency of the issuer of that currency. Okay, now the idea that by taxing it you will reduce inflationary pressures is a complete socialist trap, which basically bloats government spending on the way in of monetary expansion and bloats government size in the economy on the way out as well by taxing away the private sector. In fact, if you look at it from a Rothbardian viewpoint or from an Austrian viewpoint, it is taxing you on the way in by massively increasing government size and printing of currency way above the demand of the private sector, and is taxing you on the way out.
Yeah, and there's also, let me just say this before I forget, the issue, and I don't know what your take is on this, Daniel, so I don't want to implicate you, but I know Rothbard has written in defense of debt repudiation, and the argument was if somebody was silly enough to lend money to a government, you know, it's not that they're owed it the same way. In other words, like if the choice were raising taxes in order to pay government bondholders, that well, no, the people that you're taking the money from, you know, through taxation, that they don't consent to that. Whereas absolutely, the people who are sitting on treasuries, they voluntarily, you know, lent it to the government and say, hey, buyer beware. So anyway, again,
that's a very important point as well. Is the idea that in order to allegedly calm markets, you have to increase taxes, which we have been bombarded by the Keynesian consensus all these years. No, come on. Any tax cut and any reduction in government spending is immediately penalized by allegedly free markets. And at the same time, every massive increase in government spending and massive increase in debt, as we saw with the Biden administration, is rewarded by markets. Why is it rewarded by markets? Because it's a gradual nationalization of the economy. So if we don't understand that what we need to do to start with is to promote and to support any budget bill that addresses those two elements, the taxation and the spending in a way that may not be perfect, but we don't live in perfect times. But we must remember also where we would be going to. And I come back to the point. Think about this. I have read from a few investment banks that the impact of the increase in deficit would reduce economic growth of the United States by 0.1% every year. To start with, that is a stupid calculation, but let's assume that that is correct. Why have they not made a similar assumption of what it would do to investment, to consumption, and to a GDP growth of the elimination of the tax cuts, not extending the tax cuts, the massive increase. You see, there we have grown accustomed to allegedly independent analysis that constantly believes that families and businesses are an ATM at the disposal of government. Instead of saying, hey, the devastation to the U.S. economy would come from not extending the tax cuts, not from a gradual reduction in the deficit. I don't care. Let me explain this to people because they might not understand it. I don't care about the deficit of a government if it comes from reduction of taxes. I care about the deficit of a government when it comes from increasing taxes and expenditure. That is what leads you to stagnation and stagflation, which is the problem that we were led to by in 2021 to 2024.
Okay, yeah, great stuff, and yeah, I think you're really isolating there. That it's when if somebody says, "Hey, do you like deficit spending, or would you favor Murphy a plan that would increase the deficit?" My answer would be, "Well, why? If it's because of reducing taxes." Okay, and especially if you tell me spending is cut, but taxes are cut more, I'm totally on board with that. I favor both elements, yeah.
Absolutely. It's this absolutely incendiary concept of unfunded tax cuts. What the hell are you talking about? There are no unfunded tax cuts. All expenditure-driven deficit is unfunded. Tax cuts are not unfunded. Tax cuts are returning money that has been generated and earned by the productive sector back to the people that have earned it. They're not unfunded. The idea of unfunded tax cuts comes from people that look at the economy from the perspective of a government that is confiscatory and extractive.
Yep. Okay, So earlier, I kind of went off on a tangent when I dug up the tweet from Thomas Massey just to make that point. I wanted to return the point I was making before I got sidetracked was, besides just this high-level fiscal stuff, you also think there are some gems in here pertaining to deregulation. And so can you Absolutely. Just make that point again, that this isn't just about spending levels and tax rates. It's also about you think there's a lot of genuinely pro-growth deregulation in here.
Yeah, particularly in energy. I mean, we seem to be avoiding the important debate of the enormous burden on energy investment that was imposed by the Biden administration. It was absolutely ridiculous, and it extended not just to fossil fuel exploration and production because of misguided environmental views. No, it included infrastructure, it included generation, it included distribution. In every single aspect, completely ridiculous levels of bloated regulation in terms of energy, that needs to be accounted for. And I'll tell you why. Any economist that looks at any economy knows that there are only two sectors that really generate a huge multiplier effect very, very quickly on the economy. The construction sector and the energy sector. The energy sector is a lot more productive because it doesn't depend on expectations of tremendous levels of debt or tremendous levels of credit. But in the case of energy, the impact, the multiplier impact in terms of job creation, in terms of investment in other sectors, in terms of creation of new businesses around it, that is phenomenal. I've lived it all over the world. I was in China charge of Africa and the Middle East. You built a pipeline, and around it, you had hospitals, you had schools, you had restaurants, you had... It's very important to understand that, because anyone that looks at the United States also knows that the improvement in the 2009 to 2011 productive economy in the United States came mostly from the lottery ticket of the energy sector that came to the Obama administration, not from the enormous increase in government spending.
Yep. Okay, so let me just read here the last two paragraphs of your article. You say, any libertarian or Austrian economist should support this bill as an essential first step that may not be perfect, but is critical for the U.S. economy, and consider the Laffer curve impact of lower taxes and the economic boost of deregulation. If we don't believe in the positive effect of tax cuts and deregulation, no one else will, and the next bill will be big and ugly. So can you just elaborate on that?
We need to think every time. I understand that when we have an intellectual debate, I love it. I love intellectual debates, and I love to talk about utopia. But we need to talk about reality. And I've lived what happened in the UK. In the UK, we saw how allegedly the moderates sabotaged a budget because it had tax cuts and an alleged increase in deficit, but would have been very good and pro-growth strategies that would have been very good for the UK economy. What happened afterwards? That you immediately got the alleged moderates, the Keynesians, and what did they do? A conservative government increased taxes and increased spending, brought the UK to stagnation, and in the next election, you got a left-wing government that has already increased massively taxes further and increased expenditure. We need to defend these types of policies and these types of budgets as not perfect, but essential, because we need to always think of the alternative. If you don't think about the alternative, then we will never be able to address the massive imbalances, and we're going down the Japan way. And remember Japan, by the way. In Japan, the liberals, allegedly the center-right, no? The liberals increase government spending and they increase taxes. The socialists increase government spending and increase taxes. In France, you have three options. The three parties want to increase government spending, and the three parties want to increase taxes a little bit more or a lot. We need to understand that the only option right now to really go to the solution, the fiscal solution of the United States, strengthen the U.S. economy, maintain the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency, and start to address the enormous debt and deficit problem, is to avoid falling into maximalistic positions of saying, oh, you should have cut spending by $5 trillion the first year. Cut spending first, you couldn't. Second, if you could have, in the second year, you have Bernie Sanders and AOC bloating government spending and bloating taxes. So I think it's super important to understand this. Let's give it at least the benefit of the doubt, because we know that deregulation, that the Laffer curve effect of tax cuts, and that the improvement in exports coming from negotiations and trade are going to be revenue positive and are going to be growth positive, productive growth positive.
Just to make sure, I think most listeners probably know what you mean, Daniel, but when you say the Laffer curve effect, you're saying by refraining from raising tax rates, and also there are some other particular targeted tax cuts in this legislation, that will cause tax revenue to grow more than would be the case if you assumed that had a static effect on the economy, that by having GDP grow faster than it otherwise would because of the tax rate reductions, that makes a bigger base, so that even though there's lower rates applied, the revenue still goes up. And, you know, that's what people call the Laffer curve.
Absolutely. Is that if we don't understand that an increase in taxes coming from not extending the tax cuts would be devastating for revenue generation, and that maintaining them is at least an incentive for the economy to grow in a more sustainable and productive way, and therefore revenue positive, if we in this podcast, in the libertarian and Austrian community, if we don't understand this, then the nightmare scenario that we're living with the Keynesian fallacies, that what they want to do is to gradually nationalize the economy and make the productive sector dependent on the public sector, then they're going to win. So obviously you need to understand that positive. And we know it works. And we know that it works. We have seen it in Ireland. We have seen it in Holland. We have seen it in numerous countries. So I think the United States is in a critical point. The United States is not going to lose the reserve status of the US dollar because of the big, beautiful bill. But what I can tell you is that the United States is going to lose the world reserve currency status if it continues down the path of mandatory spending can only grow by 3, 4, 5% in real terms every year.
Okay. What's interesting is, as you were talking about, yes, this thing isn't perfect, but we need to be realistic and understand what the alternative will be. You know, if we don't pass the, in other words, it's, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're saying something like, yes, I understand it would be better if we would cut more spending and that, yes, total spending is going up still, even with this thing, but it's, you know, what we're doing is cutting a lot relative to what will happen if we do nothing. And you're saying, I believe also, if we really did try to push way more aggressive cuts and front loaded them so that, yes, spending gets cut by $2 trillion next year, which would be great from a libertarian perspective, but that would be disastrous politically. And then the left, you know, they would win a bunch in the midterms and then they would come in and they would ram through something really awful. And so it reminds me of like the debates back when it was, you know, Trump versus Kamala. And a lot of libertarians understandably said, this guy Trump, look at all these unlibertarian things he's going to do.
Yeah.
But a lot of the others who said, yeah, I agree with you, but you know what? Murray Rothbard's not running for president right now, and he's not going to win, even if he were. And so, you know, if it's a choice. So anyway, is that a fair summary or is that too glib in terms of the way you're trying to explain this?
You summarize it perfectly. Rothbard advised Pat Buchanan. Remember, please, let's be realist. I am the first one that understands everything that everybody is criticizing about this bill. Absolutely. Absolutely. But if you really think that we're going to win by going for 100 or nothing, then we will get nothing. Hayek advised Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher did not reduce government spending. Margaret Thatcher reduced government spending relative to GDP. She did not reduce it in nominal terms or in real terms. She reduced it relative to GDP. That is important. Why? Because the economic benefits came from the real economic benefits came from winning and continuing to win the elections while cementing a taxation and deregulation policy that took, after she left power, decades to unwind. That's a very important element as well, is to understand that the deregulation tax cuts, making these tax cuts permanent and making the deregulation and trade negotiations permanent, all those elements, then even if you lose the elections, it's very difficult to change them. Tony Blair couldn't change them. Gordon Brown couldn't change them. Unfortunately, in the UK, a conservative government to destroy the legacy of Margaret Thatcher. Look at the irony. But it's very important. It's very important to understand that when I have the intellectual debate, a lot of people say, you know what? I would rather that the United States gets into a debt crisis, the US dollar loses its place as a world reserve currency, and then the country would rise in a libertarian revolution. No, my friends. No, that doesn't happen. What you would get then is socialist totalitarianism. The only way in which freedom, private sector defense, supply side economics, conservative, call it whatever you want. The only way in which it works is if the middle class strengthens and the economy grows. That's the only way it does. If what you get is a collapse of the economy, the result is a totalitarian socialist dictator. And that's what, and that I don't want for the United States, for the UK, for Spain, for any of the countries that I've lived in. I think it's super important for people to understand that we can make an Excel spreadsheet calculation and see whether this bill is going to reduce 1.6 trillion of spending or 2.1, because it goes around there. But the question is not that. The question is, what would be the alternative? And the alternative is no reduction in spending, actually a massive increase in spending. And let me come back to the point of the US dollar as the world reserve currency. We also need to talk about the US deficit and the US debt from a global perspective. The US does not need to have a fiscal surplus. And this is important because the US deficit is I'm here in Madrid, but I also live in London, is also my surplus. Okay, so it's very important for people to understand that what needs to happen is that the economy grows, and therefore not only grows, but it grows from the private sector so that the strength of the US dollar continues to be the driving force of financial and markets and also of the debt market. And I think that that is relatively simple to do. Just the reason why the dollar strengthens when there is a crisis of a government shutdown is very simple. It's because the United States is the only country in the world in which there is actually the debate that you and I are having, which is great. Because in France and in Spain and in the UK, when the government goes, when the government promises a 2% deficit and it goes to 5%, it increases debt it doesn't even appear in the news. So I think that all of that, we need to put it in context. Consider the tax cuts and its positive impact. Consider the deregulation and its positive impact. Consider the permanent impact of those factors plus the trade negotiations. Consider the positive impact of reducing mandatory spending for the first time in decades. And also consider that if the economy does well in these next 12 months, there will be further discretionary spending cuts in 2026.
Okay, well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. And just to endorse, earlier your point that if we don't get this, I think you kind of summarized it. You're saying the choice is not between this or cutting spending even more, that's just not realistic. That's not going to happen. And so if we don't do this, then we might end up getting something that's far worse. And so whether the viewers agree with that or not, I think they can understand where you're coming from. And, again, for the very reason that somebody might have voted for Trump as opposed to writing in, Bob Murphy or something on their ballot, knowing that I wasn't going to win. So
you never know.
I know you I would have just I would have done such a better job. But OK, so, folks, my guest has been Daniel LaCall. And, folks, I will link, if you go to the show notes for this episode, his article. And also I'm writing up something just to kind of lay out some of the numbers or whatever. So you understand what does it mean that they're having cuts relative to the baseline, and you just get a sense of these numbers so you at least know what everybody's talking about. So, Daniel, thanks so much for your time and spelling out these important issues.
Thank you very much. And let's wrap up also by saying that we all start from the same premise and we all agree on that government spending needs to be cut further. And this is a first step. It's very, very clear. Thank you very, very much for the opportunity and this great podcast that is always riveting to listen to. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the kind words. And yes, government spending is the enemy. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. In the meantime, you can find more content like this on Mises.org.